The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, and welcome back to the Carol Markowitz Show on iHeartRadio. Last week, The View host Sunny Hoyston did one of those in-depth genealogy shows called Finding Your Roots, and she discovered she was descended from slave owners. You can see on her face that she's devastated and upset by the news. She really doesn't know how to react. Media picked up the story that Sunny's mom cried to learn about the family's slave-owning past. She was deeply disappointed. It's bizarre to me. Disappointment in your family history? Disappointment is a failure to meet expectations. You expected everyone in your family story to be a good person with modern morals? Maybe it's the Russian in me. I have no such expectations. But more than this, you cannot change the past. You can't change where you came from or the people who came before you. What has always been the glory of America is you get to start from scratch here. I lived in Britain for a few years during college in Scotland, and I was asked with some frequency what my father did for a living. They wanted to know how to categorize me, but in America, I never got asked that, ever. And the idea always was that every generation gets to start anew. The problem is that Sunny had bought into this idea that we can't shake off the proverbial shackles of the past. We're supposed to carry all of it around with us all the time. And we're certainly supposed to carry the blame of what people who may share our skin tone did. So now she's tarred by her slave owner relatives. She brought the shame onto herself. On this show, we talk about living a better life, and a lot of that is letting go. Letting go of bad things that happened to you, for example, and moving forward. But also, definitely, letting go of things that happened generations before you were born and over which you have no control. You cannot be happy if you carry around every mistake made not only by you, but everyone of your lineage who ever lived. Don't be like Sunny. I enjoyed collecting your stories to help our single friends, so let's try this again. I'm collecting stories for next Monday's episode. If you listen to the show, you know that I ask all of my guests to offer their best tip on how to improve their lives. Give me your tip. Write to us at carolmarkowitzshow@gmail.com or tweet at me at Carol on X. I'll read some of the responses on the show, so definitely tune in. Thank you. Coming up next, an interview with Neil Pollack. Join us after the break.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. oracle.com/strategic.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024, and we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question is going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you on our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun.
And I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, and welcome back to the Carol Markowitz Show on iHeartRadio. My guest today is Neil Pollack. Neil is the author of 12 very important books of fiction and nonfiction, a freelance writer who contributes to many publications, including most currently The Spectator and Observer, a three-time Jeopardy champion, and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, which you can find at bookandfilmglobe.com. Hi, Neil. How are you?
Hello, Carol. Yeah, it's so nice to talk to you. We've been social media acquaintances for a long time, but we've never actually spoken
yes.
in person.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, it's a
so
pleasure.
So 12 books, that's a lot. Which one is your favorite?
I mean, you know, they're, you know, you have several children, so you know it's hard to pick favorites. I always tend to like the most recent one.
Right.
But I'm, you know, my most recent one was a sci-fi satire of COVID politics. So mm-hmm. while I do love it, it didn't exactly find a huge audience. Before that, I wrote a memoir about quitting marijuana, which I'm quite fond of. I've written several books about yoga, but really, I think most currently, I wrote a book about a decade ago called Jewball, which is about Jewish basketball players in Philadelphia in the 1930s fighting Nazis. So
I feel
like that one that one really rings true to me these days, given you know the current political situation. So I'll pick Jewball.
I feel like I have to check out some Jewball.
Yeah, it's really good.
So what's your, like, how long does it take you to write a book? I only have the one book. I say it's my first and last book. So the idea of 12 books is really crazy to me. And I just want to know more about it.
When I'm rolling, I could knock one out in about 6 months. I have a novel that I've currently been working on for more than a year. And it's going slowly, largely because I spend a lot of time playing competitive poker, and that just seems mm-hmm. to...
We'll get to that.
it consumes a lot of my brain space, so I don't... Mm-hmm. My creativity, you know, isn't always flowing. But when I'm going good, and my books are pretty short. When I'm going good, though, about 6 months for a draft.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I think of poker as a completely different side of my brain, like more practical, more like... I don't know, just not the artsy, you know, kind of fiction part of my brain that I would need to write fiction books. I see it as like math more than writing. I don't know, but yet you say that
it's much
you
math,
feel like poker
like
gets in your way.
Well, it's like math and it's like sports, right? So, you know, I'm it's an intellectual activity. So I just find myself thinking about it a lot. And the what, yeah, it's different parts of the brain, but, you know, I only have so, much brain. So, so it's like, so if the neurons are firing in that direction, I tend to get distracted.
So we originally connected, I think, over the fact that we both play poker, even though it's unfair and the worst. What do you actually enjoy about the game?
Well, like you said at the outset, I won some games on Jeopardy, right? So like I had that feeling of like winning big, you know, of like being the champion, of hitting the jackpot because of my mental acuity. And, you know, poker, while the edges are a lot smaller, right? Like I'm a really like good competitive trivia player, and you know could beat like 99.9% of the population in a trivia competition. Whereas in poker, it's like I could beat 52.3% of the population in sometimes.
Yeah,
you know, it's like there's a lot more there are a lot more variables. So what I like. The idea of like somehow like just walking into a card room with $100 and walking out with $4,000, which occasionally happens, but really, it does. Or you could also walk in with $1,000 and leave with zero, which also happens. But I like the winning.
Yeah. Do you keep track of your wins and losses?
I have a spreadsheet. Yeah.
Okay. I think that's really important, and I've like put a lot of kind of younger poker players onto that idea because they've like never even considered tracking it. You know, it's just like whatever's in their pocket that day.
I have a spreadsheet, and I also like I'm extremely parsimonious, I guess is the word. Really careful with my money. So you know, I have a poker fund that I keep in a secret place. Like
call that a bankroll.
A bankroll. Like I keep it in the wall, like Matt Damon in Rounders, and I pull it out when I have to. And I, other than like occasionally like going to the bank and getting $20 to pay a fee or like an entry something, I don't use my actual money to play poker. So I have, you know, and then I have an online thing where I play for pennies just to kind of get the hand reps in. You know,
how long have you been playing?
On and off for about 20 years. I can only imagine what it was like to play me in the Commerce Casino in LA in 2004. Because I mean, I was stoned out of my mind. I had no idea what I was doing.
So was everybody else.
But I was like playing for, you know, I was like buying in these cash games for like $40 and always losing. But I've been playing, I would say, somewhat seriously since about 2019.
Do you think you could support yourself with it if you had to?
I don't know. It's hard to say. It's hard to say because I had a $60,000 win in 2022. You know, I finished second in a $600 buy-in tournament. And, you know, that's a ton of money. And I walked out of the card room in Round Rock. I live in Austin, Texas, and Round Rock is a suburb just north of here. I walked out of the card room at like 5 a.m. with a manila envelope full of Franklins. It was great. I went home and I dumped them on my wife was sleeping in bed. I went home and dumped them on her. And
did she enjoy that?
She did. Although she was like, no, I can never tell you can't go play poker again. I was like, we bought a car with it. We went on vacation to Mexico City. We were able to do some house repairs and stuff we were waiting to do. But then since then I'm about even, you know, I'm about 500 player. After that, I went on a $7,000 downswing, and then I quit for a while. And I started up again, and I won a few thousand. I lost a few thousand. So it's like I would have to like have a big starter chunk of money in order to even try to make a living at it. And I like playing tournaments, and that's the variance is huge.
Yeah. I think the only way to, I know that a lot of poker players would disagree with this, but to me, the only way to make a living playing poker would have to be cash games because when you're up, you have to walk away from the table because you got bills to pay and you can't just, you know, you can't just ride it out and see where it goes like and the way you would have to in a tournament.
I'm not a great cash game player either because I get real nervous about money. So if I get up, then I I often blow it, and if I get down, I get really depressed. And I just the way that people play in cash games doesn't really register with my brain. Whereas in tournaments, I like the sort of ebb and flow of the strategy.
Yeah.
And so I just prefer that kind of game, even though the variance is absurd.
Right. I think the just emotional roller coaster of poker is hard to maintain. I don't know how people do it, but yeah. I've done it. I've been through periods in my life where I supported myself playing poker. I used to work on campaigns, and in between campaigns, I would play. And I was always like a 1-2 cash game player, which for people listening, that's like one of the lower levels. And I never wanted to move up. I like a lot of people would get really good at 1-2 and then move up to 2-5. And I'd be like, why would I want to play better players? Like, I want to play the people who are here at the 1-2 table that I've gotten good at. I never quite understood the need to move up to higher levels if I've gotten good at the one that I'm at already.
Yeah. I mean, and I play tournaments because, again, like tournaments is about not about making money as much as it is about winning trophies and bracelets and rings. And I've driven up to Oklahoma to play at the World Series of Poker circuit events at the Choctaw Casino, and like, you know, gotten to a couple final tables and gotten pretty close to those rings. And, you know, that would be really great to accomplish. It's like the intellectual accomplishment of it.
Right. And also the money. The money is good.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I like money. But I'm also realistic, you know, that the real goal is just to kind of stay in the game. And then if I hit a jackpot, like I did a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you've made it?
You know, that's an interesting question because like, I've written 12 books. I've written for like pretty much every English language publication under the sun, except for the New Yorker. I mean, there was a time a few years ago where I had satire columns going simultaneously in Salon and The Federalist. You couldn't ask for like a wider ideological range of publications. I had a column in Vanity Fair. You know, Jeopardy. I was a guest on The Daily Show back when like my writing career was really booming 20 years ago. So I've really kind of like accomplished most of what I set out to do in life. You know, let's say
you haven't managed to ban kids from restaurants, which I know is one of your big, you know, big issues that you care about.
I don't have the time and patience to set up a foundation. You know what I mean? I would like to see that happen. So of course I have disappointments like that. So yes, in some ways, like I've pretty much accomplished it all. And if I were to die tomorrow, which I'm not going to do, more than likely, I think, you know, you could say that it's kind of been complete. Right. But on the other hand, like I find myself thinking like, well, shit, you know, I've never gotten to make a TV show or a movie. My career, while I'm still in the game, amazingly enough, considering that, you know, the attrition in this business, I'm still in the game, but you know, I had a higher status, let's say 15, 20 years ago than I do now. You know, I'm now just kind of like a guy who's still kind of playing around in the ecosystem. So sometimes I have those disappointments. So it's like, yes, I've made it. On the other hand, I'd like to get back to where I was in some ways too.
So what kind of movie or TV show are you looking to make?
Probably something in the realm of comedy would be good. You know,
Hey, you're funny.
Yeah, I know, right? You know, what was it? It was about not quite 20 years ago. I had this book called Alternadad about being a hipster parent, which was a thing among Gen Xers. Back in the day, there was this sort of when Gen X started that reproduce. I was obsessed with making sure that my son was cool and was into cool Gen X things, which I think was a sentiment that a lot of people of my age in general, sociological background shared. And so I wrote a comic memoir about it, and it got some press attention. I did the touring circuit, and I it was optioned by Hollywood. So, you know, we moved to Los Angeles to try to turn it into a movie or a TV show. Yeah, we sold our house, and because like it was looking good, right? And so I had, you know, and there were moments where it looked like it was going to get made into something, and it just kind of fell apart on me. And then we lost all our money, and we had to move back to Austin in shame. And, you know, so that was kind of rough. And then since then, there hasn't been a lot of opportunities. I am sort of vaguely thinking that it would be interesting to make something funny about poker. Poker does occasionally pop up in film and TV, but there hasn't been a good show or movie about like contemporary poker. I guess there is that Jessica Chastain Molly's Game thing.
Yeah, that was good, but it wasn't funny.
It wasn't,
you know,
fun to watch. Mm-hmm. I mean, the poker. You know, when I went back and I watched it again, like the poker. There's that whole subplot with that, like the reg at the Commerce Casino who got bluffed by an idiot in a home game and then lost his mind and died. I was like, well, yeah.
Was that the guy who folded the nuts, the
second nuts.
No, I think there was a hand like where somebody folds the actual nuts, like
something like, I think what happened was he had these second nuts and there was this idiot who always who doesn't know what he's doing, had absolutely nothing. And this good poker player folded. And lost $100,000 or something in a hand, and then like that sent him on some kind of spiral. Anyway, so that movie was good, but it was like there was also a lot of scenes of Jessica Chastain skiing. So, I'd like to try something in that realm maybe. And also, I've been for years, these screenwriters and I have had these two novels about a L.A. private eye who was also a yoga teacher, and we've been kind of futzing with that and seeing if we can adapt that into a show. You know, I feel like the yoga world is always right for satire, something like
mockery,
mockery, and also I practice yoga, so mockery and
you
respect.
Do.
I have, I've been practicing for more than 20 years.
That's really interesting. I would not have imagined that.
Yeah, I'm a certified Ashtanga Vinyasa instructor. In 2010, I moved to Colorado for a month, and I studied with this, I guess you call him a man. He's more modest than that, but he's like a yoga master. And I went to his intensive workshop and studied with, like, it was like serious, like chanting in Sanskrit.
Wow.
And like anatomy. And I mean, we did a lot of physical stuff too, but I took a Buddhist meditation course at the Shambhala Center in Boulder. And so I take yoga seriously, but it's also quite ridiculous.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back on the Carol Markowitz Show.
Welcome to season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024 and we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question, it's going to be a good time the whole time. We hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun, and I can't wait for you to hear it.
Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how, I don't know where, I don't know what. God, if you show me, God, if you tell me, God, no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A question I ask all of my guests is, what do you consider the largest societal or cultural problem, and do you think it's solvable?
Well, we talk about this a lot on Book and Film Globe. I think that there's a sensorial attitude in our culture that I think is really damaging. I feel like, you know, on the left, for instance, in England, they're like Baudelaireizing P.G. Wodehouse, Rudyard Kipling, Agatha Christie, other sort of classic authors, mm-hmm. Roald Dahl, and they have these sensitivity readers, and they're changing the books in certain small ways. And I just think that's ridiculous. And then, you know, during COVID especially, you saw how intolerant liberals, specifically liberals, I wouldn't even say the left, the liberals were about mm-hmm. Ideas that they didn't agree with. You know, there were a lot of that's what the whole Twitter files thing was about. There were a lot of efforts to shut down dialogue and just control the discourse. I didn't like that. And I will say, I know you lean toward the conservative end of things. I will say that there's also that attitude to some extent on the right, particularly in Texas recently, right, where I live, the state tried to get bookstores, not middle school libraries. It's one thing if you're like, uh-huh. Well, maybe a middle school library shouldn't be putting comic books about gender transition on the shelves. I kind of feel like anything's fair game, but I can understand that point of view. But they were saying that bookstores, like independent bookstores, had to put like warning labels on books that had like sexual content in them. And I'm like, that's just like Tipper Gore, you know, trying to, you know, ban Run DMC or whatever from the 80s. That's just a bunch of moral majority crap. So I don't have any time for that either. So I feel like people just need to like stop censoring and stop thinking that censoring anything is a solution. You know, like this country, this society is built on the foundations of the First Amendment. It is sacred and it is inviolable. And I feel like people just need to, if something offends them, you have to freaking deal.
They should be offended.
They have to deal with it like adults.
Right. It used to be getting offended was just part of life. Now it's like something we need to like curtail.
Well, there's always been this puritanical strain in American culture. I mean, there was the Hays Code in Hollywood. There was the Comics Code. You know, there's a moral majority of the 80s that, like I said, Tipper Gore trying to put warning labels on records. There's always this strain, but it doesn't ever seem to go away. And so if you think something is too sexual, tough. If you think something isn't woke enough, tough. Expression is fine, you know? I mean, even, you know, I mean, I remember when the ACLU, you remember that, in the 70s, the ACLU defended Nazis marching in Skokie,
right.
Illinois.
I mean,
that's not, they wouldn't do that now. They would try to ban them.
No, they
them.
Wouldn't.
They would try to ban them. I'm Jewish. I don't want to see
you
Nazis.
You love Nazis, right?
I'm horrified at the anti-Jewish sentiment in the culture right now. It's driving me crazy. But
right.
I would never for a moment say, don't let them express it. We have to let air out all that stuff. So anyway, there's a lot of problems in society, but that to me, that's the one that I feel like is the most easily solvable. You know?
Interesting. Easily solvable.
Well, I mean, easily solvable if everyone would just stop censoring or thinking that censoring was good. I mean, it, you know, because the law, the First Amendment is there. It hasn't been repealed. You know, it's like it's right there. So just
right. It is right there. Yeah.
It's not like we have to you know, institute freedom of speech as a new value in our society. It literally is the founding value of America and possibly America's greatest contribution to the history of world culture.
Right. So. But I would say that it's become at least, you know, the kind of bigger problem that I've seen with this in the last, you know, decade, and I'm sure you've seen the same, is that people get targeted for their kind of mainstream sometimes opinion that people just don't like. They get fired and, you know, the story of Jennifer Tsai getting fired from Levi's, or, you know, being forced out at Levi's for saying that kids, schools should be open during, you know, COVID is just the classic story of that for me, which is, you know, it's not First Amendment, right? It's not like,
It was more, but
it wasn't the government shutting down her speech. It was like being targeted for thinking the wrong thing.
That's like a scarier
and more difficult thing to solve, I think.
Right. It's not a government problem, but it's still, it's the same principle, right? And I know Jennifer Tsai, I'm part of a group, this sort of COVID skeptic.
You don't talk
group.
About the group, Neil.
I know her. Like, this is like a chat. Am I supposed to talk about that? There's like,
no, I'm kidding. It's Fight Club. You don't talk about it.
Anyway, I know her, and like, you know, and I experienced the same thing during COVID. I mean, I didn't have it. I'm not getting fired from my job by my boss for saying that movie theaters should be open. That was my big campaign during COVID. It was like, movie theaters should be open because you're not getting sick. In movie theaters, I went on and on and on. And I lost some contributors to my site over those opinions. And I lost some marginal friends.
Yeah. I have to admit that I remember you going to the movies, and I was very anti-COVID regulations and all that, but I was still like, ew, I would never go to the movies right now.
I
definitely remember thinking like, that does not seem like a good idea.
It was fine.
It was fine. Obviously it was fine. But I'm saying like, even me who was opposed to all the regulations, I remember thinking like, I wouldn't go play poker because poker's always like the grossest, you know, place in the whole casino.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, and I wouldn't go to like various conferences. Like CPAC is a conference I go to a lot, and everybody always comes home sick from the CPAC. And I was like, no way am I going during COVID. Yeah. And movie theaters, I just thought, you know, they're kind of always a little gross. And I am a germaphobe, but I'll admit. So I remember you going to the movies, and I remember thinking like, oh, I wouldn't do that.
I'm not a germaphobe. I'll eat stuff off the kitchen counter that's been sitting there.
No.
So my wife wouldn't let me go play poker at the card room until after I got vaccinated. I'm like, fine, I'll play online, whatever. I mean, I really didn't care. Like I was out and about. I went to parties. I went to bars. If I knew anyone who was willing to do anything, I did it during COVID. And so I was living in Austin, and, you know, Greg Abbott like reopened the state before COVID even got here.
Yeah.
You know, May 1st, 2020, he didn't have the guts of like DeSantis in Florida to like actually challenge politics, but he did. He reopened it, including reopened movie theaters. So they opened some movie theater at an entertainment complex in Kyle, Texas, which is like 20 miles south of my house. And I was running this website about film and books. So I got in my car and 20 miles. It took me about 10 minutes that day because there were no other cars on the road.
Right.
And I went to see Vin Diesel in Bloodshot.
How was it?
Not great, but it's like everything else that was playing I'd already seen before they started shutting shit down. So I, it was me. And so I walk in, I'm wearing a mask. You have to. And there are all the signs, the 6 foot signs, and everything's under plexiglass, and like there's a photographer from the Austin American Statesman taking photos like I'm a refugee like arriving on the shores, and I'm like don't take my picture, I'm working here. And so I went to the movie with my little box of Junior Mints that I bought at Walgreens, and I was like lifting my mask down and surreptitiously nervously putting the mints in my mouth, and then there are like four working class Mexican guys in the back row not wearing masks, eating popcorn, not giving a shit, you know.
Respect. They hadn't heard about COVID.
Whatever. Respect to them. And then I didn't die.
Yeah. Hey, I mean, you not dying was a big step forward for people like doing stuff again.
I feel like it's true.
I agree.
In a small way, it's not like it was front page news or anything. So then I kept going. Like, there was that weird Russell Crowe movie, that revenge movie, Unhinged, that came out, that they debuted that. I went to see that. Like, there were three other people in the theater. I went to, they did a revival of Blade Runner at the Paramount Theater downtown. Going to see Blade Runner on a summer night in 2020. That was about as dystopian in an empty downtown. That's about as dystopian as you can get. I went, Tenet, all that. And I just kept going to movies. And just I went to see, there was a Freaky Friday horror remake starring Vince Vaughn, who like swapped bodies with a cheerleader. I went to see that. And I wrote about that. People were furious at me. I was just fuck it. I want to go to the movies. I'm going to keep going.
You were the hero we needed at the time. Didn't know it. We didn't know it then.
Yeah. And no one remembers now, but it's okay.
I remember.
I appreciate that, Carol.
So end here with your best tip for my listeners on how they can improve their lives.
Well, let's circle back.
Stuff. Yeah.
Let's circle back. I would say, look, if I can do yoga, me, like a middle-aged schmuck, in suburban Texas, can do yoga every day for 20 years. I mean, you can do yoga too. I practiced yesterday. My legs are sore today, but I feel good. And I woke up, I'm 50, almost 54 years old. I woke up feeling not a day over 51.
Nice.
Yeah. it's really good just for sort of maintaining a baseline of mental health. And sanity and just physical fitness. You're not going to get like ripped unless you're doing it all day, every day in some cult in Los Angeles. But it will help you like kind of get through the day, with a calmness and a clarity. It'll help your sleep. It'll help your digestion, all that stuff. So I would recommend taking
yoga.
Yoga practice is really good, and you don't have to, it doesn't have to be, hippy dippy religion, there's no need for any of that. You can go that route if you want. And I have occasionally gone that route just to the part of the world, but you don't have to. It can be very practical. And there are lots of examples of people who have lived very long and, healthy lives just by doing yoga and not eating like crap all the time. So all
interesting.
The time.
I mean, you're my second unlikely guest to have been into yoga. Kevin McCullough was the first, and it's very interesting because I really would not have guessed it with either one of you. So
it doesn't
I like that.
It's not, yoga gets this bad rap as being like something that like rich, dumb coastal liberals do.
Yeah,
right,
and it does.
And for good reason, because they do a lot of it. But they're also very, a lot of those people are very physically healthy.
They are.
And maybe insane, but mentally, think about, there's a reason for that because of their practice. So it's like, but yoga itself does not like, it's not about politics. There's lots of right wing Indian people who do yoga.
Right.
India is run by a right wing populace. There's no age requirement, there's no politics requirement, there's no it's not about an ideology. It's really just about like focusing on your breath and like doing basic movements and like, not stealing from people. Unless you're playing poker. In which case
the last one seems like you might have just added that on, but
no, that's one of the presets.
All right, no stealing,
not being a huge asshole.
Yeah, all right, I like that. That's a really good ending there.
Yeah, don't be a huge asshole.
Thank you.
That's all I'm saying. All right, you're welcome.
Thank you so much, Neil. It was really nice having you on. Thank you.
Let's do this in person sometime.
Thanks so much for joining us on the Carol Markowitz Show. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC,
we dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.